Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
Our next storyteller is Dr. John Kerstetter. He was a colonel in the Iowa Army National Guard. He served in the National Guard from 2002 to 2008 when he retired. But that doesn't tell even half the story of what happened. He tells the whole story in his book. It's called Crossings, A Doctor Soldier's Story. He completed three combat tours in Iraq. Starting in 2003, he served as a combat physician and a flight surgeon. Please welcome Dr. John Kerstetter.
Well, good evening. Thanks for being here. Appreciate all the support. Let me get this out of the way, and I don't mean it out of the way in that sense. I want to really do this, so indulge me, please. For all the veterans here, all the service people, all the families, you know what? I just want to do this as a colonel of the Iowa National Guard. I salute you. Thank you for your service. Appreciate it. Well, at age 34, I went to medical school, Mayo Medical Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota. I finished in 4 years. At age 42, I joined the Iowa National Guard. I was the old man. I required an age waiver to get in. And they needed doctors, so they said, not a problem. At age 53, I did my first tour in Iraq. At age 54, I did my second. Age 55, I did my third tour in Iraq. I was injured there. I came home. I had some peripheral injuries, not related to getting shot, but there was a missile that landed in front of us, so we took evasive action and got hurt. Somebody asked me what the most important thing was I did in Iraq, thinking that it might be saving lives, and we did do those as a medical corps officer. But I would say this, there's two things that are very important to me. On my second tour, I was delivering patients, medevac patients, to the hospital in Balad, the Air Force Theater Hospital. And it was during the Battle of Fallujah and the Battle of Mosul that I was coming from Mosul. And I had several young medics with me who was their first tour, in fact, their first month in combat. And I delivered my patients to the hospital. And as we waited for our helicopters to return and come back and pick us up, two Marine helicopters landed with Marines from Fallujah. And the medics and the Navy corpsmen offloaded six patients from each helicopter. And I'd seen this many times before. As they brought them into the front door of the hospital, about 50 yards away, half length of a football field, there was a trail of blood that led from the heliport to the front door of the tent. My medic, never having seen that before, went over and said, "Hey, Doc, look at this." I said, "Quit doing that." He said, "What do you mean?" I said, "The ground you stand on, that's holy ground. That trail that you see, the dark trail from the pad to the door, that represents the blood and the sacrifice of soldiers who gave life and limbs for you and me and for our people back home. And we just need to understand it." Now, he'd never seen it. And he said, "Yes, sir." And later, at the end of the tour, he said, "You know, that made such an impression on me. I never thought of it like that, like a trail of sacrifice. But that's exactly what it was." And the second thing that really emboldens my mind with a vision of sacrifice and service was this. During my first tour in the latter months, the general and I had the occasion to visit one of the hospitals I knew where there were several IED patients. And one of them was in what we call a triage room. And it's a room where we decide as medical officers that we won't treat this patient because their injuries are too severe and they can't sustain life. So we decide very early on to forego treatment and to spend the rest of our time with other patients. We had a patient like that. And the general and I went there to visit, and this soldier's fellow soldiers were at the foot of the bed with his captain. And I said, there's nothing left to do here. And the general said, well, there is one thing. Let's pray. And so we did. And the general put his hand on this soldier's leg. And in a few moments, I just felt this sensation as a father. I said, what would a father do in this situation? In fact, I had my own four children at home, two of which were the same age as this soldier or older. I said, they'd do this. So I went up to the head of the bed. I put the soldier's head in my arms. And I said, it's okay. It's time to go home now. And I held him. I loved him. And I let him die as a father, not as a soldier, not as a doctor, not as a general, but as a father, as a fellow human being. And that was the most significant, I think, of all the things that I did there. Well, I finished my tours. I came home. I had surgery for my own injuries. And at the end of the time when I came, I had about a year's worth of surgery. In a final surgery, it was a neurosurgery, there was an accident and I had a stroke. When I woke up, I was no longer a doctor. I was no longer a soldier. I was a stroke patient. And I never did regain my capacity as a physician or a soldier from that point on. That was 2007. So I've been 10 years as a stroke survivor. And what happened in those early years was very difficult. Needless to say, I worked my whole life to become a doctor, and all of a sudden it was gone. It was ripped away. I said, how is this possible? This doesn't happen to doctors. It doesn't happen to soldiers. This can't be. Yet I'd spent the entire 3 years previously in combat seeing exactly those things happen every day. So my wife and the therapist said this, why don't we apply the same soldier toughness, the same mission readiness to this new objective of getting well, of recovering, that you applied to the mission in Iraq? And I thought that was a pretty good idea. So we started to do that. Well, and here's how that went. My therapists taught me how to make lists. And that was kind of a paper brain. That had, everything went on a list. My medication in the morning went on a list. Doctor appointments went on a list. My early therapist said, kiss wife on the list, first thing in the morning. It's not on a list, not going to happen. Sorry, honey. And list. 2 years into list making, I become quite a master list maker. I'm thinking PhD here, this kind of stuff, see? And Colin sits me down one Saturday morning. She said, let's make a grocery store list. I want you to go to the grocery store. Can you do that? Sure. I'm a doctor. I can do that. Five things on a list. Hamburger, ketchup, buns, toilet paper, toothpaste. That's it. Five things. 15 minutes. I put the list in my left pocket. I walk out the door, into the car. I forget. I have a memory issue. I go to the coffee shop instead. I'm there 2 hours. I cover coffee, politics, you name it. We've solved it. 2 hours. Everybody leaves. I think, you know, I got to go to the grocery store. I don't know why, but I feel like I need to go to the grocery store. I go to Hy-Vee, walk in the door. Now, mind you, the list is in my left pocket. I don't remember. I'm a stroke patient. I don't have to remember. It's there. Five things. I wander up and down the aisles. I get over to the meat section. It's seafood day, seafood week. There's king crab legs on ice. Shrimp, lobster swimming in the tank. I look around, I settle for two big giant T-bone steaks and a half a dozen king crab legs. I put them in the cart and I'm thinking, The lady says, can I help you? Well, yes. She said, you know, I've got some cranberry sauce with horseradish. It goes well with the steaks. Here, have some on a cracker. I take it. It's good. Wow, I think. I've never had that. In the cart goes two bottles. I'm thinking, what goes well with steak? Wine. I go over to the wine section halfway across the store. Half hour in the wine section. The labels are beautiful. I love them. Oh, my gosh. I can smell the grapes. I pick a nice Cabernet, you know, from Spain, put it in there. What goes with wine? Ah, cheese. Off I go. Half hour in the cheese section. I got three blocks of cheese, Canadian Black Diamond. And there's a cranberry goat cheese spread, of course. What goes with cheese? I got to have crackers in the box. In the cart goes five boxes of gourmet crackers. I'm thinking, I was supposed to get something maybe? I don't know. Let me wander the aisles. I do. Pickles. I have to have pickles. They're on sale. Cake mix. Well, if you have to have cake mix, you have to have frosting, and you have to have cream cheese. I go to the cream cheese. There's yogurt. I've never seen this many different kinds of yogurt. In the cart they go. 12 cans of yogurt. I'm thinking I'm missing something. Aha, French bread. Back to the meat section I go in the bakery. In the cart goes French bread. While I'm here, I'll just add four eclairs just for effect. I'm still not sure why I'm doing this. I wander around. I think, my wife is lovely. She's kind. I'll buy her something. Jelly beans, jelly bellies, yes, a pound of jelly bellies, in the cart it goes. Well, I've got eclairs, maybe there's a quart of Ben & Jerry's ice cream. Fine, in the cart. Up I go, at the counter, the lady says, did you find everything you needed? Yes, thank you. She said, looks like you're having a party. Just the two of us, I say. The bill's $120. How much is hamburger? You know, $1.50 a pound? I don't know. Well, home I go. I walk in the door and I plunk down seven bags full of stuff. My wife says, what's this? Where's the list? What list? I gave you a list. Don't you remember? It's in your left pocket. I pull it out. Oops, I say. She's a bit upset. I say, well, I can't take blame for things I can't remember. I hated lists. I grew to hate lists because they always reminded me of what I didn't have, of the fact that I had to put things down, that I couldn't remember, that my memory was short. And on and on and on it went. But you know, 2 years later, when I'm managing the effects of my stroke, and at the time, I was reading at the second and third grade level, mind you, from a doctor's level reading all the way down to the third grade. Third percentile in reading capacity. I had to restructure everything. Couldn't remember medical knowledge. Had a hard time remembering who I was sometimes. Difficult. Had a hard time walking. I've had 10 years of therapy to compensate. And here's what I thought about in the last few years. I made a list of things that don't need a list. You know what they are? They're pretty cool things. You go to the art store, you look at art. You see the beauty of the colors. You see the fantastic wild brush strokes. You can smell the paint. You can smell the trees and the art. I listen to music. My wife teaches a special needs class with music and dance. You can feel the rhythm. It makes your bones move. That doesn't need a list, does it? I have six grandchildren. I go to their homes and I put them on my knee and they say, Grandpa, give us a horsey ride. Yeah, let's go. Make it the purple horse. That's the fastest one. And that doesn't need a list, does it? There are all those things that don't need a list. I watch a beautiful Iowa sunset. And I think of the kind of wild spontaneity and the bliss of life that we can live unhampered by lists, and I love every moment. And then I get this thing. Every now and then, I'll grab my wife by the hand, just for no reason at all. Once in a while, I'll give her a little peck on the cheek. Sometimes I just say, you know, thank you. I love you. Not on the list. And I've learned that through the lessons of Iraq, through the lessons of tragedy. There's also the lesson of humanity. there's the moment we can say, let me hold you while you pass from this world to the next. And I've also learned that in spite of the loss of career, we all have these things. Yeah, I wrote a book about it. It's called Crossings. We all make a crossing from one station in life to the next. And the most beautiful crossing I've made is the understanding that there are hard lines, for sure. But a lot of those lines we can challenge. And the most beautiful line of all is the line of love. And that's the line I'd like to give you tonight. Love does not need a list. Thank you.
Dr. John Kerstetter, thank you so much. All right. Time to move on to our next story. Major Tim Nash is here in the Iowa National Guard. He's an Iraq veteran. He served as an ambulance platoon leader in Baghdad in 05 and 06 and as a public affairs officer in Diyala province from 09 to 2010. He's currently the command for the Iowa Medical Detachment out of Camp Dodge, Iowa. This is a fun fact. The last time you were here, you were getting married in this building. His wife, Kate, and they have a son, Colin, who turned one just last week. So congratulations. That's pretty cool. Major Tim Nash.
Good evening. Yes, it's nice to be back here in Old Brick. Probably one of the, I don't know if, probably the best night of my life was in the night my son was born, which is just about a year ago. But I mean, definitely probably top five nights spent here in this room with my wife and my family and friends when we got married. So some of y'all were there. I was served two tours in Iraq, Medical Service Corps officer. When I look at my two different tours, the first one is the one that really sticks out in my mind because I was kind of that young, bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, innocent, if you will, young platoon leader, kind of that quintessential young officer. For those of you that are vets, kind of have that idea of the butter bar, negative or positive. So my second, I think I was a little more wise, and the job was a little bit different. But my first tour was, I was in the green zone, and I had about eight medics and a crusty master sergeant that I worked with. And we were the ambulance platoon for Ibn Sina Hospital, which was the hospital in the green zone there in Baghdad. And this was the hospital that Saddam Hussein had for all the members of his bath party. And it was a very nice state-of-the-art facility. It was very uncommon. It was not the standard to what you would see throughout, as far as medical facilities went, throughout the rest of the country. And I was, of the veterans that are in this room, how many of y'all are familiar with the term FOBIT? Show of hands, FOBIT. There's Dina's got it. Yeah, so it's a derogatory term for soldiers that don't go outside the wire. Outside the wire is basically out into where the combat's happening. We're kind of back behind the walls in the safe area. So all we had to worry about were mortars. But it was a fairly safe area for us to be in. And our mission while we were there was, our hospital, it was a primary treatment hospital. So as soon as somebody was wounded, whether it be a U.S. service member or Iraqi soldier or a civilian contractor, or Iraqi civilian, if they were in the vicinity, they came to our hospital. So what our job was, as the ambulance team, our job was to, once that patient was stabilized, our job was to get them kind of to where they needed to be. So if it was a contractor or a U.S. service member, we would we'd give them a ride over to the LZ. I can't remember the name of it. I think it was Liberty. But we'd give them right over the LZ, and we'd send them either to, they'd be getting on a helicopter to Balad, where they would be flown out to Longstuhl in Germany, or if they were actually ready to return to their unit, they'd just hop on a Black Hawk and they'd go back to their unit. That was kind of a secondary mission. Our main mission was Iraqi civilians or Iraqi service members who needed to go convalesce at an Iraqi hospital. We would load them up onto our ambulance and we would take them to checkpoint one, which was the checkpoint that was called Assassin's Gate. It's kind of been kind of, I think people have heard of it. It's been glorified a little bit in stories and things like that. But at any rate, we would take these patients to checkpoint one, and we would meet an Iraqi civilian ambulance, and we'd do a patient exchange. And we would hand the patients off to the Iraqi medics, who are just like my medics, only they're Iraqi, and they would take them to a hospital to convalesce. And that was our main job. When people think of Iraq these days, I think there's kind of a negative connotation. I think we think of things like what's happening with ISIS and things of that nature. But I tell you, in 2005 and 2006, the Green Zone was actually a really exciting place to be. I think that it was before we ramped up soldiers in 2007, 2008, and there were really exciting things happening. And I remember telling my parents about the stuff that was going on. My mom probably remembers me talking about how the trial of Saddam Hussein was happening right down the road. And my medics had the honor to provide medical support to the first seating of the Iraqi Congress, which was really cool. That was also, I believe that was the first year that they did free elections in Iraq. So I think that at the time there was just there was a good vibe going on in the Green Zone. I think there was kind of we all felt positive about it. So I don't want to be all doom and gloom about how things were going. I think we felt like we were really there doing our part in something that was very significant. But anyway, what I really wanted to talk about today was one of our other secondary missions while we were there in Ibn Sina Hospital was we were there to augment medical staff in the event of a mass casualty. Now, if you're a medical officer, or if you're medical at all, you know exactly what a mass casualty is. And basically that's, it's an event where you're gonna have enough patients coming into your facility that you're going to essentially overrun your resources. So it's an all hands on deck kind of a thing. And any open space is a space for treatment. And I think we had three or four. I can't remember exactly how many we had that year. But I remember the very first one. And the Blackhawks are coming in. We'd heard about it. We knew it was happening. So we had a couple of gators, like four-wheelers, ATVs out there, because that's how we would take them into the emergency room. So we had a couple of gators out there and even more, not just medics, but all personnel. Like everybody was out there because we were there to unload patients as fast as we could off the Blackhawks and get them into that emergency room. So the secondary mission for my medics was to augment the emergency room in the event of a mass casualty event. And so I remember that first one, the Blackhawks landed and we're waiting. The chief will know what I'm talking about. I can't remember the name of it right off the top of my head right now, but the guy, he'd come off the Blackhawk, he'd motion you, you'd come out, you'd get the litter, carry it off the LZ, get him on the gator. If there's not a gator, you're carrying him in there, and you get that patient into the emergency room. And I remember once all the patients were there, we were like, okay, everybody, you know, I had my eight medics. We all went in there, and my master sergeant immediately took charge. He went, spoke with the NCOIC, got his medics engaged. They started doing their job. They're treating patients. And it's probably, you know, it's what you would think it would be. It's pretty much complete chaos and lots of yelling and lots of panic, but you're trying to control everything. And I ended up kind of standing in the middle of this chaos. A lot of people don't know that military, but a medical service corps officer has no medical training. We're pretty much just admin. We have as much medical training as an infantry soldier. We have as much training as any other soldier would have. So I'm standing there in the middle of all this chaos and seeing all this stuff and feeling really helpless, like not knowing what to do with myself, because once my medics were engaged, I really thought that I had nothing to do. And so I went to the patient admin and I said to the E5 there, the sergeant, who knew who I was and he knew what my job was, he knew I didn't have any training. I said, hey Sergeant, what can I do to help? I gotta do something. And he said, sir, right now, what you need to do is you need to go back out those doors and you need to go donate blood. And back in the back of the hospital, we had a trailer and it was a blood unit. And we had a little blood center going on there. And I think we had 3 or 4 beds. So I went out there and sure enough, anybody that was non-medical personnel, they were all lined up. And folks were going in donating blood. And that was kind of like my new, it clicked. And that was just what you did. If you didn't have that medical training, but you were working there in the hospital, that's the first thing you did. And I became pretty passionate about blood donation after that. That's just kind of something that I knew it was important, something I should do. To bring that back full circle, that was in 2005, 2006. I came back, I went back to school, I got a film degree from here at Iowa. I worked as a phlebotomist at BioLife. I became a public affairs officer. I had another tour in Iraq. I came back, I worked in recruiting for the Iowa National Guard. And then I got a job with the Mississippi Valley Regional Blood Center. And my job is to work here in the community to organize blood drives. And that's what I do for a living. And when I really want to try to help people understand why they need to donate blood, I go back to this story. Because I was that person standing there, that young man who had no medical training. I didn't think I could help, but there's all this chaos happening around me. And they said, go donate blood. And something, after I'd done the job for about a year, 2 years, and something clicked with me because I'd thought about this. And what clicked with me was that we are all that same person. And we're all sitting here and we're going about our everyday lives. And we don't understand that there are people fighting for their lives every day in our hospitals. And we don't think we can do anything about it, but we really can. And what we need to do is we need to take that time. It doesn't cost you any money. Not everybody's eligible, but those that are eligible need to take that time and go out and really try to save a couple of lives, try to help some people and donate blood. So that's my call to action for you, and thank you all for coming out tonight.
Major Tim Nash, thank you very much. There should be a long line at the blood bank tomorrow. You ready, Bill? Spec 5, Bill Ryder, served in the U.S. Army NSA, 1966 through 1969, a crypto analyst and linguist with the 509th Radio Research Group in Saigon. Welcome, Bill.
Thank you. Well, I'm honored to be here with these other veterans tonight. I'm humbled to listen to their stories. Every one of them has brought up things in my own memory of my time and the veterans I've dealt with the last 50 years. The last speaker talked about blood. And I'll tell you a little story that this is totally extemporaneous. but it's from a book I'm writing that includes 16 weeks of group counseling with other Vietnam veterans back in the late 80s. I was tricked into going to the Vietnam Veterans Center in the first place. A blizzard was coming. We lived in a country subdivision 20 miles outside of Casper, Wyoming, elevation 7,200 feet, and we had been bombed with blizzards all winter long, and another one was on the way. Saturday morning, my neighbor come flying in his pickup. I'm going to the grocery store in town. Do you want to go along? Do you want to give me a list? And my wife says, yeah, he's going. She made a list real fast. We went flying into town. The blizzard has started. We get to the grocery store. We load up carts, and we get everything we can think of because it might be 4 or 5 days before we get back to town or longer. And we get back in the truck, and instead of going towards home out northwest, he heads to downtown Casper, the wrong direction. He pulls into this old abandoned gas station, which is now the brand new Vietnam Veterans Outreach Center. They painted it inside a little bit, degreased it somewhat, didn't do anything on the outside. One of us got a plywood board and put Vietnam Veterans Outreach Center on it. Anyway, Jim pulls in there. I said, where the hell are you going? I want to go in and check on some bennies. You want to come in and meet some people? I said, hell no, I'm not one of them crazy sons of bitches. I'm just stay right here. Well, he took his keys. It was 5 degrees outside. About 10, 15 minutes later, I decided maybe I needed to go inside and meet a few people. So I got a cup of coffee in the little coffee clutch there. Out of one of the little tiny office cubicles came this crazy looking guy, long red hair, long red beard. He had beads on. He had a gator vest, a cowboy shirt, cowboy boots, and bell bottoms. He was one of the counselors. Well, he goes into the coffee clutch and he gets a cup and he comes over and sits right beside me. I mean right beside me. Hip to hip. You're a vet, ain't you? Well, yeah, so. Yeah, your neighbor Jim, he told me about you. So, well, okay. Well, you seem kind of defensive. Is something you ashamed of being a vet? I said, well, I don't know. It's in your damn business. How come 20 years after that war, you're not proud as punch about that, that you're not happy about that? I bring it up and you get kind of testy. What's the deal with that? Well, I said, I'm kind of pissed off about that. About 10 minutes, he had me screaming, so I said, you better calm down and come into my office. Somebody's going to call the cops. So we go into his office, and I all but trashed it, the things he was asking me about my service. Calm down, Bill, he says. We got groups starting next week, guys just like you. They're just angry as hell. 20 years after their war, don't you think we ought to try to do something about that? So I joined the group. I agreed to go. 24 people, 4 women. We were represented by a lot of colors. Most of us were Caucasian and knew where our ancestors came from in Europe. There were a couple of guys of African descent who had no clue where they came from. There were 2 Navajo, a Cherokee, 2 Mexican, and 1 from a place that we call now Mumbai. So the first night, we kind of, yeah, I served in this unit, and I'm an electrician, and I've got a son. I was born and raised in Iowa, that kind of thing. That was the first night. I think it was the third night, finally we got down to the reason we were there. We all had at least one horrific memory, something that was kicking our ass for 20 years, but most of them had many that went around and round in our heads like a crazy carousel. But the first one in that group to actually talk about why we were there was a woman, a former Army nurse. Her husband asked her to go because of her sleepwalking nightmares. He would find her in their kitchen, quietly sobbing. And the next minute, screaming the house down, "Where's the fucking whole blood?" Tearing into the refrigerator, throwing food across the floor, looking for it. And that's how it started. Group session with Vietnam vets. And the leader was a woman. Now to the story I came here to tell you. I was on my way to the grocery store. No, just kidding. Mothers, I can't find a title for this little story. I've messed with all kinds of things that have Latinate references, you know, Ursa Major falls to Earth when the planet altered. I'm just going to call it, mothers are like grizzly bears when they have to. Well, just like my mother, her friend, Obera Bragg, was made of a special kind of stardust. You could tell. She was a little taller than she was wide, with a radiant, dark brown, dimpled face. And she could silence all the birds and get all the dogs barking. If she yelled or laughed full out, she also happened to be the mother of Earl Lee and Joel Frederick, best friends of my brother Danny and I. But she and George called Earl Lee Punky, and they called Joel Pickle. We knew, however, if she called for her sons from her front porch using their Christian names, it was time for us to hightail it on home, because somebody in our fearless bunch of desperados were in tenuous circumstances with the law. We did not want to witness the carnage or get any of it on us. She always had a lot of good things to eat, too, if we happened to be over there robbing trains or chasing bandits at just the right time. And of course, we knew to the second when that would be. That was the same pretty much with our mom, too. Though she was very pale in comparison, with pink in her cheeks and shoulder-length strawberry blonde hair. This is the hard part. On the last day of February, 1969, Punky was still a Marine in Vietnam. I myself was just home a couple of months. It was 3 days before my 21st birthday. Mom, a registered nurse, was simply on her way to work, the night shift at the hospital. Out on the highway, a drunk in a pickup hit her car head on, killing them both instantly. He was a young farmer, only 40, the same age she was. He only had 6 kids still at home. There were 5 of us. Well, after a fitful night, as you can imagine, I awoke with a start the next morning before sunup. I swear to God, I heard snakes hissing, a sound I knew well. And then I realized I'm in my own bedroom in Perry, Iowa. What is that? So I get out of bed and I grab a broom and I open the door and the lights are on in the living room. There are 2 women taking inventory, whispering, fingering and fondling mother's things on the bureau in the hutch, digging into the closet. They even went into the folks' bedroom where no one was allowed. It was one of my aunts, trust me, by marriage only, and one of her friends. It's damn lucky for them Dad wasn't home. He'd left the night before, right after midnight, right after the highway patrolman and the police chief came by with the news about the accident. I believe he was on an important alcohol-fueled mission outside our solar system at the time. Lost somewhere among the stars. I don't know if he ever saw the irony in that. I sure did. I often wondered why. Was he looking for an answer? Was he looking for her? I still don't know. Well, I went after those 2 with my broom, chasing them out the front door, across the yard, down the hill, and into the large tan Oldsmobile, swinging at their behinds every step I took. And I gotta tell you, it was really satisfying to remember how they screamed and squealed with every swing I took, even though I only landed part of the time, because you can't get much traction in snow in bare feet. And I kept slipping and falling down. When I got back to the house, I found another woman there, Obera Bragg. She was in the kitchen laughing herself silly. Tears were in her eyes. She had obviously enjoyed the dance spectacular pas de trois that I had just performed for them. She was in front of the open refrigerator, just laying in a little something, she said. Then she grabbed me and hugged me and took my breath away. When she finally let go of me, I could see on the dining room table a big bowl of oatmeal sprinkled with cinnamon, filled with raisins and walnuts. She also brought along a big covered baking dish of shepherd's pie. Food references, I hope you notice. A cauldron of split pea soup with ham. She had fresh loaves of bread. She had a couple of dozen cornbread muffins. It occurred to me she must have baked all night. Then she woke up the 4 younger kids. And when she was satisfied that we had all eaten and were decently dressed, she commandeered us into getting to work. You got to get busy. All kinds of people are going to show up here before you know it, and you got to be presentable and have your house ready. And she told Danny and I, the oldest, you 2 boys go downtown and, for crying out loud, get your hair cut. And to me specifically, Billy, get rid of that scraggly hippie beard. Well, you may know that the world can go sideways in half a second and try to shrug you off. But Obera Bragg tilted the entire planet our way again by herself. Thanks.
Bill Ryder, thank you so much. And thank you all for sharing your stories tonight. Thanks again for coming, everybody.